I'm going to try and wrap up my talk about the Dalai Lama's views today. And if I don't, the only thing that will be left over is the fourth reading, the final reading, Science at the Crossroads, which is really kind of the segue into the balance of the class and explains why we're doing the balance of the class on psychology of religion in the way we are. Because that article and the comments he makes in it really explain from a methodological point of view why we're doing what we're doing. But to go back to the problem of religious pluralism, so we left off on page 220 where he talks about the value of religion in the modern world. And he says, okay, it's valuable. Then he goes on to say, so how might we overcome the harmony that is necessary to overcome interreligious conflict? Because he recognizes that it's going on. I mean, he's no fool about this. And he says, the key lies in developing understanding. We must first find the factors that obstruct it, i.e. understanding, and then we must find ways to overcome them. So already he's sort of diverging a little bit from somebody like Eck. Perhaps the most, he says this on the page, top of page 222, perhaps the most significant obstruction to interreligious harmony is lack of appreciation of the values of others' faith traditions. So on the one hand, he's going to make some assertions about how to deal with this problem. But the main issue is, he's saying, you need to understand other religions if you yourself are going to be pluralistic in your attitude and non-prejudicial in your attitude. And essentially, this is his prescription for everybody, if you really get right down to it, although on a practical level, it might not be possible. He says, so there are a number of things that are necessary. One is, he says, I believe that the best way to overcome ignorance and bring about understanding is through dialogue with members of other faith traditions. Now, even though he's proposed developing an appreciation for other faith traditions or religions, he says dialogue. He doesn't say sit down and read and study, which is really unusual for him. I mean, he comes to this later, but he starts out by saying dialogue. And the reason he says dialogue is similar to what he says on the next page, that people going on joint pilgrimage is important for bringing about religious harmony. Because what he's saying and what he's recognizing is that the issue is not merely intellectual, that I think there's something wrong with that other religion, or it's alien and strange, or I don't get what they're doing, although he recognizes that's an issue. What he's really saying here is that the human relationship that comes out of dialogue and comes out of jointly doing pilgrimage is transformative and develops appreciation. So that he's prescribing something not just on an intellectual level. He's prescribing actual brotherhood, sisterhood between people in how they relate to each other, even though they're of different faiths. That, you know, sort of being apart from each other physically is not going to be a good thing. So I guess in that sense, the world that Eck describes is a useful world. Because if you have a Muslim down the street this way and a Hindu down the street that way, if you open yourself up to who these people are as your neighbors, that begins to open you up to understanding what their religions are. But you have to be in communication and relationship with them. The bottom of page 223, he says, it will also become clear that irrespective of doctrinal and other differences, all the major world religions are concerned with helping individuals to become good human beings. I'll emphasize love, compassion, patience, tolerance, forgiveness, humility, and so on. And so this is the main theme that he pursues in talking about plurality. And he looks at it in the following way. I guess I'm jumping ahead here. He's going to draw a distinction later on between ethical values, doctrinal differences, and direct religious experience. And he's saying that at the level of ethical values, all faiths really are arguing or speaking to the same thing. That if you practice Islam, if you practice Buddhism, if you practice Christianity, the qualities that you develop as a human being, which have to do with, which are the things he mentioned, such as, you know, tolerance And he doesn't mean just putting up with other people. He means, like, actively engage with other people and appreciate them, compassion, so on and so forth. These are values that are in all religions, and they are. I mean, we tend to think of Islam as a violent religion, but if you actually listen to what the Muslims are reciting every day when they pray, they say, in the name of Allah, the merciful, the compassionate. They say this every day. In their view, Allah is merciful and compassionate. That's core. Those are core values of the faith. Okay. Here's where we start getting into something. I won't say it's dicey, but a little bit more serious. Engaging in dialogue with followers of other religions is necessary, but as he says on the first full paragraph on page 224, we must, of course, implement in our daily life the teachings of our own religion. So it's not just enough to talk to other people and have faith in your own religion. You have to do something about it. You have to live your own values. We come to see the overriding importance of genuine practice when we recognize that, along with ignorance, individuals' unhealthy relationships with their beliefs is the other major factor in religious disharmony. Far from applying the teachings of their religion in our personal lives, we have a tendency to use them to reinforce our self-centered attitudes. And what he's saying is our tendency is to take religion as something that reinforces whatever attitudes we have, good, bad, or indifferent. Usually prejudicial can be the problem. And therefore, that's what he calls an unhealthy relationship with our own religion. Therefore, we have to address that particular problem. And that's actually the core problem in people not getting along from the different faiths. But, he says, yet we must acknowledge that this reflects another problem, one that is implicit in all religions. I refer to the claims each has of being the one true religion. He says, how are we to resolve this difficulty? Well, we've been talking about this for weeks now. In practical terms, this involves individual practitioners finding a way at least to accept the validity of the teachings of other religions while maintaining a wholehearted commitment to their own. Then he says, as far as the validity of the metaphysical truth claims of a given religion is concerned, that is, of course, the internal business of that particular religion. He talks about this a whole lot in the problem of exclusivism, which is the second to the last article I'll have you read. Now, do you understand the subtle distinction he's making here? This is kind of interesting. Yeah, Forrest. And difficult.
You said this was on page 224?
225 of, 225 of Ethics for the New Millennium. So I want to ask if you, Forrest, do you understand this subtle distinction that he's making? Shall I repeat those two lines?
Please do.
Yeah, okay. Because I think this is difficult. In practical terms, this, which as to developing this altitude of multiplicity, in practical term, excuse me, pluralism, this involves individual practitioners finding a way to at least accept the validity of the teachings of other religions while maintaining a wholehearted commitment to their own. So on the one hand, I'm a Christian. As far as I'm concerned, Christianity is the best way, period. However, I'm going to accept that the Buddhist way is also a good way and correct for Buddhists to get them to wherever they want to go. That's the first part. Second part is, as far as the validity of the metaphysical truth claims of a given religion is concerned, that is, of course, the internal business of that particular tradition. So I'm not going to, what? I'm not going to try and judge what's happening in another religion. And this is a challenge.
I mean, if it suits, starts with understanding that maybe that's not the best way for you. He said you have to only practice. So, like, you still practice your daily rituals, but it's important to understand that what they have to say is not invalid because what you're doing
Right. But if, but imagine, that's correct. And now imagine the difficulty. You're a Muslim, say, okay? There is no God, lowercase g, but God, capital G. There is no God but Allah. This is a creedal statement in Islam. There is no God but God. That means there's no alternative to God. Your next door neighbor is a Buddhist, doesn't believe there is any creator God at all. Every day, your practice with absolute devotion is one of submission to the creator God in whom you firmly believe. And yet the Dalai Lama is saying, if your neighbor is a Buddhist who doesn't believe any gods exist, that God exists at all, it's incumbent upon you, if you're really going to get along with your neighbor, to say, that's okay. I'm not going to even try and figure out what your faith tradition is about. I'm just going to assume it's good and it works because you're a good person, even though it utterly and directly contradicts everything I deeply believe. That's hard.
But if the, neighbor's a bad person, you can't just say, like, you're a good person, that's why I believe that.
All right, that's a different matter. If your neighbor is a Buddhist who's a thief, steals your lawnmower as soon as you turn your back, you know, that would be a different matter. But let's just make the assumption that your neighbor is not a bad person. And he walks over to your house every once in a while and says, you know, I got some extra gas. Would you like it for your lawnmower? Okay. Okay. So what... So Forrest, yeah, back to...
If I'm a practicing Muslim and I do my five times a day, I do my prayers and I do everything, but I still am able to notice that the Buddhist neighbor is, you know, good person, he, from whatever I can tell, you know, treats the people around him well, and isn't that, like, for your society to mesh, that's what's required? Mm-hmm. Like, you just, interactivity without extreme bias.
Right.
It doesn't matter, like, what they think as long as they're doing it in a reasonable way. And we're completely off the conversion topic. So
right.
if we're not trying to do that, then what they're doing, in fact, isn't negatively affecting us. It's even positively affecting us.
Right.
We can accept that with an open mind.
Right. So you would think there shouldn't be a problem.
I don't.
Right. And at the level of social interaction, that's what everyone is calling for and says that there'll be no problem. But I think he's asking for something a little bit deeper than that.
That dialogue?
Once you get into dialogue, then he's asking you to basically say, I don't think you're correct. And I understand pretty well, I think I understand your view about reality, which I don't think is correct. But that's okay. I mean, see, the problem for most people, This is getting ahead a little bit because it gets to the, and I probably won't get to it, so I'll just mention this. It gets to this issue that he talks about in the chapter from The True Kinship of Faiths. It's really hard for a human being to be fully devoted to a certain point of view and 100% accepting of another point of view, which is diametrically opposed. I mean, it's okay to say, I'll give you an example. We'll shift away from religion because it might help make the case. Politically speaking, I'm more of a Democrat than a Republican. My next door neighbor, who's really a wonderful guy, we get along really well, is a hardcore Republican. Why is he a Republican? Because his family, he grew up in a Republican family. Because if I really sit down and talk with him about things and look at what his values are, his values and my values are pretty similar. But the way he sees himself expressing those values politically is through the Republican Party. I would see myself expressing those values through the Democratic Party, except for the fact that I think they're all corrupt and it doesn't matter. But that's a different issue. On a more emotional level, that's what I'm saying. So now I have to find a way to put up with the fact that all the decisions he's making, I see having negative implications for me. When he votes for a Republican senator who opposes Social Security, that directly affects me in a negative way. And it's, from my point of view, it's going to directly affect him in a negative way. As one of the economists upstairs says in the conversations he has with his students, you're opposed to Social Security? Okay. When you're an adult, you want your parents living with you? And a lot of students will say no. He said, well, then you better be supporting Social Security, because unless your family is wealthy, they're going to be living on Social Security or they're going to be living on your paycheck. He says, well, that turns a lot of heads around, right? The point is that these things are not merely abstract, right? And so it becomes very hard if I'm holding my views and fully understand another person's point of view and their views, and they're really different than my own, to accept that two views can have equal validity, but I still accept my own and reject the others. That's hard. That's really hard, yeah.
One of the big problems I see with this is, like, a lot of different religions pride themselves on doing mission work and converting others to theirs.
That's true.
And that's completely contradictive to, like, this point he just brought up.
Well, and he will open, because he recognizes this. If you go to any of the talks that he does in the United States, he will say at the very beginning of his popular talks, not specifically Buddhist teachings to Buddhists in the American community, but popular talks, he'll say, my view is that people should stick with the religion of their birth. I'm not here to convert you. In fact, I don't want to. I don't think it's a good thing. I'm here to talk to you about universal values. And if you have some respect for me, then listen. If you don't have any respect for me, or you don't think this makes any sense, then sit back and eat some popcorn and enjoy yourself. But what I'm definitely not doing is I'm not here to convert you, because he's recognizing the flip side of exactly what you're talking about, which is, if he's saying, he's walking his talk is what he's doing, really. I mean, that's the easiest way to phrase it. He's walking his talk. Because it is a problem. Because it is a problem. Now, the problem is compounded if the doctrine of your religion includes conversion. So he doesn't really talk about that, but we know that that can be an issue. I mean, we know that there are many Christian denominations where the doctrine includes conversion. In some particular way. Sometimes it's gentle and sometimes it's not so gentle. You know, when the folks from Jehovah's Witness come to our front door, you know, they're offering us literature, but what they really want to do is they want to convert us, because from their point of view, we should join them because they have the truth. I mean, even if I were a Christian, they would think that, you know, I should join them, because they have the truth. That's part of what the religious practice is. It's required if you, is there anybody in this class that's Mormon? Okay, it's required if you belong to the LDS, Church of Latter-day Saints, or Mormons as we typically call them, it's required that you go out on a mission. That is part of the deal. Well, being a missionary is not like, well, I'm going to go to Bangkok and I'm just going to enjoy the curry. You know, the whole point of going to Bangkok is to convert people. And if you're just sitting there enjoying the curry, you know, you're not doing what you're required to do as part of your religious faith. So it does become a problem. And where we see the excessive form of that is in Islam, people like to say that jihad, holy war, is about the internal war. And in some ways, you can look in the Quran and you can see that Muhammad is saying that. But all you have to do is read the history of Islam, and you know that's only not only about internal war. You know, that Islam was spread by warfare. I mean, this is a historical fact. Now, in the 21st century, we can sort of nice it up and say we don't do that sort of thing anymore, or we don't agree with that. And Muslims can say it's symbolic, and that would probably be a good thing to do, because we live in a world where jihad doesn't go over very well. We're living with it, you know? I mean, basically, the attack on the World Trade Center in 2001 was an example of a fundamentalist view of the Muslim relationship with the Western world and a reading of jihad as okay, as empowering people to engage in what we call terrorism. They don't call it terrorism. They consider it holy war. They consider it a proper expression of their own religious values. This is not all Muslims. This is a conservative, fundamentalist, radical understanding of it, but it is there. And so how you deal with this problem? How do you deal with the problem now if you're a Christian and you fully understand the Muslim point of view in regards to holy war? How do you reconcile the tension of that, which then turns you into the enemy? Okay. So he's saying some things which I think are intellectually interesting, but I often wonder about the limits of them. I'll give you another example of this. If you read the Quran, you find that Jesus has mentioned the Quran. There's a very interesting video that went viral on YouTube recently in which a Fox commentator is interviewing a Muslim scholar who's written a book called Zealot or Zealots. What's that?
Oh, I just thought I watched that.
You saw that, okay. Now, I haven't seen it, so I'm going to say this from the comments other people have made to me about it, and correct me if I'm wrong about this. The basic point of view of the interviewer was, you're a Muslim, how can you write a book about Christianity? And the author said, well, I'm a scholar, so I can write a book about Christianity. I don't have to be a Christian to write a book about Christianity. I mean, I don't think he said this, but there have been plenty of good books written by Christian scholars about Islam or about Buddhism or what have you, you know. But to this interviewer, it was impossible that a Muslim could have anything to say about Jesus or about Christianity. Is that your back that made that noise? No, that was the chair. That was the chair. Okay. Okay, so what did not come up in the interview, and the scholar could have said this, but apparently didn't, and of course the interviewer didn't know this, is that Jesus is mentioned in the Quran a number of times. So Muslims know about Jesus, but what they have to say about him is really surprising. For one thing, they reject the idea that he's a divine incarnation. For a Muslim, Jesus is not the Son of God. That's impossible, because there can't be anything other than God. So for God to have a son means two gods. That's going to be a problem. And if you look at what the Trinity really refers to, it refers to three sort of expressions of one divinity. But Muslims would say there's something seriously wrong with that. That's irreconcilable. So the Quran has Jesus as a great prophet, a very great prophet. Not only that, the Quran speaks to an end of days. We'll be talking about the apocalypse. Well, there's an apocalypse in the equivalent of an apocalypse in the Quran. It's not like St. John's apocalypse. But there is an end of days. And at the end of days, they say, who do you think shows up to usher in the end of days? It's Jesus. Jesus shows up at the end of time, just before the big end of the world, when everybody, you know, there's a big winnowing out, if you will. Some people go to heaven, some people go to hell. It's not like a rapture or something like that. But it is an end of days story. And it's the end of time when Jesus shows up. Muhammad doesn't show up. Jesus shows up, right? So, you know, the interviewer didn't, of course, know that. So a good Muslim knows all about Jesus, but the problem is that the view of Jesus in the Quran and the view of Jesus in any Christian faith are significantly different. Because what's Christianity if Jesus isn't a divine incarnation? There's something essential missing, right? But that's fundamentally something that's not acceptable to Muslims. And the Muslim idea, therefore, is fundamentally unacceptable to Christians. So then, how can these people be neighbors and understand each other's faith fully? That's the problem. Now, all of the people we're reading say at the level of ethics, and human relations is where we get it all sorted out. And in many cases, they say you want to understand these other faiths as fully as you can, but they don't really speak to how do you deal with the problem of the faiths being radically different. Now, the Dalai Lama tries to do that. Let's see if I can find the passage. Well, for one thing, he uses the metaphor of medicine, which is to say, you know, your faith is good medicine for you, my faith is good medicine for me. And your faith might be bad medicine for me, you know. So, like, if you go to the doctor and you have the flu, and he says, I'll take your appendix out tomorrow, that's not going to help the flu, right? that's essentially the difference between good medicine and bad medicine. He says each faith is good medicine for people of that faith in that situation. But he goes on to say, my way to resolve the seeming contradiction between each religion's claim to one truth and one religion and the reality of the multiplicity of faiths is thus to understand that in the case of a single individual, there can indeed be only one truth, one religion. However, from the perspective of human society at large, we must accept the concept of many truths, many religions. To my way of thinking, he goes on, the diversity that exists among the various religious traditions is enriching. But the point he's making as we read farther is, he says, if you contextualize things, essentially, and you understand that in a certain situation, that truth is good over there and this truth is good over here, and you understand that context, time, space, what have you, determine what's good and not good, that resolves the problem because it allows you to recognize the validity of the other faith. But the downside to that, from my point of view, is, anybody have a shot at what it might be? Relativism. Because if I recognize that truth is determined by context, doesn't that relativize my own truth in regards to my own faith? Right. So if I'm a Christian and I recognize that I really believe in Christianity, not because it's the final truth, but because my parents were Christians and I'm living in a Christian culture, doesn't that relativize the truth of that particular faith? It seems to me it does. For most people, it's going to be a problem. So, but he does say that this is the way out, and it's kind of okay. He said, from his point of view, it's the way out. In the article on religious harmony, he makes two key points. So I'm going to jump off of this, and hopefully we'll have time that you can see how these things loop back. The two key points are, the second paragraph, he says, the root cause of these man-made problems is the inability of human beings to control their agitated minds. How to control such a state of mind is taught in the various religions of this world. That's the value of religion. And then the second key point he makes in this, and this is the one I want to focus on at the moment, then we'll come back to the mind issue later, probably when we're talking about psychology. The bottom paragraph on the second page, I want to emphasize that it is extremely important for practitioners to sincerely believe in their respective religions. Usually I say that it is very important to distinguish belief in one religion and belief in many religions. The former directly contradicts the latter. Therefore, we should resolutely resolve these contradictions. That doesn't seem to follow logically, but he says this. This is possible only by thinking in contextual terms. A contradiction in one context might not be the same in the other. Now, it's not entirely clear to me what he means by this. He seems to be saying that if you put religion in context, sort of like having the medicine analogy, that it solves the problem of seeing how one faith is true and another faith is true in a different context, even though those truths differ with each other. That's one way of thinking about this. I have a different interpretation. You all know who Albert Einstein is, right? Everyone knows Albert. Brainy nuclear scientist, among other things. Quotation. We cannot solve our problems with the same thinking we used when we created them. We cannot solve our problems with the same thinking we used when we created them. When he said this, he was thinking about nuclear annihilation. So the level of thought that was involved in creating the atom bomb was not a type of thought or a level of thought or a level of sophistication that's necessary to avoid using the bomb and annihilating all life on the planet, that a higher order or a different type of thinking is required. I think if you consider what the Dalai Lama is saying, from that point of view, we need to resolutely resolve these contradictions. This is possible only by thinking in contextual terms. So thinking about things in contextual terms, having a historical, analytical point of view, a philosophical, interpretive point of view, is having a higher order of understanding of things and looking at things in a different kind of way. And I think that that's ultimately his prescription for solving the problem, which is that it's not enough to have dialogue with people. That's good. It develops emotional relationship between people in different religions. Not enough to just fully understand other faiths, because from my point of view, the consequence of that is it develops an ambiguity and a potential sense of relativity in regards to your own faith. I mean, if the Christians are right and the Muslims are right, then why should I be a Christian rather than a Muslim? And then what happens if you have Islam saying one thing about Jesus and the Pope saying something else about Jesus? How do you resolve that? I think the way you resolve that is by going to a higher order of understanding of things. For example, if you view religions in a historical point of view rather than simply a theological, doctrinal point of view, right? So this is a new way, this is like Einstein saying, a new way of thinking about things. Then you look at the historical development of Christianity and Christian doctrines, and you begin to wonder, what did Jesus actually say? And you look at the historical development of Islam and Muslim doctrines, and you wonder, what did Muhammad actually have to say, right? Then you can look at these two traditions as they developed historically and culturally, and you can say, you know what? There are ambiguities in these traditions. There are certain things we're not certain about. There are some things we are certain about, right? And maybe there's a place where the fundamental differences between these faiths are not as vast as we thought they are. Now, the Dalai Lama says the idea that all faiths lead to the same goal is something he rejects. But here we're looking at things from a different point of view. We're not saying that all faiths lead to the same goal. We're saying that all faiths serve a certain human purpose, which is a different matter. So how can we say that? How can we understand that? And I think the answer to that is found in this article, Science at the Crossroads, which is the last one I'll have you read. And I really do hope you read all these things, because basically what he's saying here is that if you investigate, I'm not going to even quote from this, what he's saying here is if you investigate human nature and you think about human beings as having minds and bodies, and pretty much all religions will agree that that's the case, the problem then is that religions are addressed mostly at taming the mind and body. That's what morality is, right? Don't eat too much. That's taming the mind, or is it taming the body? I don't know. Avoiding adultery, is that taming the mind, or is it taming the body, or both? Sometimes it's hard to tell the difference between the two in regards to these issues. But all religions are aiming at a taming or cultivation of the mind and body of the individual. So then, if we look at how does the mind work, and how does it relate to the body, and how does that relate to what we call religious life, maybe that tells us something about how different religions work, tells us something about the potentials for plurality of religious life, and tells us something about how to bring about more harmonious and just order in the world by using an analytical approach to what is the human condition. Not a doctrinal approach, not the approach of one religious theory and doctrine versus another religious theory and doctrine, but to look at what is religiosity in a psychological sense. What is religiousness or religiosity in a psychological sense? Does that help resolve the problem? So the answer to that question then is the next 6 weeks of this course. That's why I've taken that tack. If you read the material in greater detail that's in the Dalai Lama's article, specifically that last one, you'll see the segue where we jump off to that. So, now,